Dr. Rock's radio show. Thursday 9 p.m. to midnight on peoplesinternetradio.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. You listen there at the beginning of the show to, as you all know, one of the Doctor's favourites, Horace X and Darkness Falls, and the night shall be filled with music. Followed by the Alabama 3, inimitable Alabama 3, and the night we nearly got busted from Exile on Cold Harbour Lane. And finally, the Darkness, and I Believe in a Thing Called Love. So a bit of a mixture of stuff there, plenty of more music to come. But tonight, I'm very pleased to have a live guest that I met earlier on in the year at the Fire in the Mountain Festival. A man called Robert Howie Smith, who is responsible for a social enterprise which supports regeneration and the use of derelict spaces to create artistic opportunity, which is a whole mass of really great stuff, I think. So thanks very, very much for making the time to join us, Rob. I really appreciate it. Thanks for being here, mate, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here. Or not be here, as the case may be.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. Talking over these virtual wires we are.
Yes.
It's always good, though, to get a bit of insight into a rare project. And yours is described primarily as a PhD study in regeneration and creative community. So which came first, the physical drive to create space or the PhD?
Well, the physical drive to create space as an artist, I think, originally. You know, you graduate from university, you've got all intentions to create great bodies of work, et cetera, and then you've got to go and find the space to do it. And what we did back in 2000 was get our own space. You know, it wasn't about plugging into the system that was already there. It was about creating your own space. And plugging into it, well, not plugging into anything, creating your own, in essence. Mm.
So the first manoeuvre was when did you finish college? Have you always been an artist, or was it something?
I'm 50 now. I went back to college at 30, having had a successful career in pub management and opening bars in Nottingham. And at 30, I decided to educate myself and did my A-levels. When I left school, I just left school and went straight into employment. So at 30, I did my A-levels. I'd become interested in photography and basically did an art and design, an art history and English literature A-level.
What was it like going back to college at that age? Did you find it easy being amongst so many young people, or were you with a lot of mature students?
Well, you know, going back to school with 17-year-olds as a 30-year-old was quite an experience. I'd like to think I made a few friends, though. And certainly this business and pub management itself, I think, really kept you always around younger people. And I'd like to think that's had an effect to keep me young, but who knows?
Did you find your experience in running bars and actually being out in the world helped you to study? Did you find it easier being back in, you know, than it was at school?
I never had studied. You know, I was a troubled kid probably at school and sat at the back of the class rather than the front. And I had no real interest in education, I guess, or inspiration, or even knowledge of where education might take you back then. Mm-hmm. It was all about leaving school and getting a job.
Yeah, well, it may well be. I think that I've always had a suspicion myself that actually a little bit of work experience and time out in the world might well facilitate education, that we kind of tend to approach it maybe with a bit more enthusiasm when we get a bit older and know what it is that we're missing and what we're looking for, perhaps.
Well, I think so, yeah. I don't think I knew what I would have gone to college to do when I was 16 years old. As I say, it was not part of my growing up. It was never going to be. Subsequently, by going back to it, I think, if anything, it wasn't my business acumen that helped me through college. What it was perhaps a little bit of maturity that allowed me to focus on it.
Mm. Plus the fact that I guess that you realised that, that in order to do what you wanted to do and be what you wanted to be, you needed some space to do it in and decided to take responsibility for that need, which is quite unusual.
Well, I think that also stems back to that same sort of upbringing, is we didn't, it's not, nothing's landed in, on our plate, so to speak, as much as perhaps it is now. Mm. And I'm sure that people would disagree with that, but I think more so I'm just of a breed that works hard to achieve what they're going to get.
Yeah, it is true. I guess there is a case, isn't there, for suggesting that it's easier to get things on the plate here and now than it has been in the past. But it's actually quite hard to get it to stay on the plate long enough to get a chew on it before some bugger nicks it off you.
Well, I certainly think in the arts, and this is what I've discovered in the last 20 years or 15 years, perhaps, is that in the arts, there is no real springboard into the business. It is hard work and very little support.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that it's actively discouraged interest in the arts or drama or any of these creative fields. I've kind of watched certainly the world I've been brought up in kind of slowly but surely become a what I call a one size fits none society, where unless you're willing to just work and consume, you're not really very welcome, and it seems to me that most of the artistic community fall into the not really welcome category.
Well, I think we've got a system, haven't we? We've got certain arts that get supported, certain arts that you plug into and can do the rounds of the established galleries, etc. And then equally there's the diversity. And the diversity is by being something that is not out there already, I guess, really. And that's proven over years that those that have managed to push their diverse arts enough to create their own platform, create their own stage, music being a fantastic example of it, eventually sways the establishment, so to speak, to actually support it in the end. So perseverance, I think, is anything. But those vacant years before you actually achieve something is very unsupported.
Yeah, and it does tend to be the musicians, if anybody, who make it, doesn't it? Maybe the odd novelist, but you don't really see that many poets and artists making it whilst they're still alive anyway.
Well, like I say, there's not necessarily the right platform for them. You know, we've been influenced as a society to accept certain things and not like other things. But gradually, even myself being an example of it, is if I was to perceive to be following alternate methods to achieve the same goals or same aims, and certainly more benefits, then eventually, as it's proving, the establishment plugs in.
Yeah. And looks at you. Mm. So you basically spent the last 15 years not only working to provide these platforms, but also pursuing a PhD in the process. How does the kind of academic side of it mix in with the hands-on side?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing I'm going to say is I am certainly not an academic. the first 2 years of the PhD, I started in 2011, having already done 10 years of practical work. It was always going to be that I came at this as a practice-based artist, and I must admit that the first 2 years was understanding the language that the academics use.
Mm-hmm.
And I still don't know that I've got it.
So finding the words that explain suitably for them what it is you're actually doing on the ground, is that the challenge there?
Well, I think so, yeah, certainly is I've got now a practical project that ran for 10 years under the guise of the art organisation, where we went round several cities and made spaces. It was all non-profit. There was not really much money involved in it. And what I've tried to do since starting the PhD is focus into different types of templates of buildings using Nottingham, which is my hometown, as my project base, for want of a word, and then look at the different templates and then look at what the academics and the writers have written about over a long time. You know, this isn't what I do isn't new. what I do is maybe unique in the fact that I've approached it a lot more business-like and yet tried to keep some ethical aims behind it. But really how we've treated our cities and how we've vacated spaces and at different periods in different decades face similar problems to what we're facing now. And this has been written about for a long time by some very specific writers.
What do you think's been the most useful stuff you've read from the academics? What's been most helpful to you in the stuff they're putting out?
Well, I think book-wise, if we go back to the 60s, I was very inspired by reading Jane Jacobs. And Jane Jacobs wrote about the death and life of the American city. And basically, early 1960s was pointing out the importance of keeping creative spaces, keeping community spaces, et cetera, et cetera. The next sort of generation or the next decade was a writer, and it's going to come back to me. Typically, I've just gone out of my head. Yeah. Sharon Zukin. Sharon Zukin wrote about the loft spaces in New York as they were being converted from industrial to accommodation and into workspaces. Obviously, in the 60s, 70s, that was the big shift, wasn't it? We were coming out of the industrial age into the beginnings of probably more the retail age, where cities expanded their retail, and we stopped living in cities and we started to move to suburbs. So there's all logic behind why spaces became empty, you know, industries died. You can think of the shipbuilding in Liverpool as an example. And subsequently, Sharon Zukin documented these creative spaces that were popping up in the old industrial warehouse units.
It was pretty shrewd of those people to spot what was going on, wasn't it, really? Because it had just started then. It pretty much gathered pace so that places like Chicago eventually lost substantial portions of their population and became more or less ghost towns, relatively speaking, didn't they? But that wasn't till a fair bit down the line from the 60s.
Yeah, I think they're obviously immersed in it. I was very lucky to be invited to go to New York, meet Sharon Zukin, and take part in one of her classes earlier this year. And in meeting her now, I could still tell that she's very community orientated and supportive. And I guess really that voice for those even then forgotten artists or ignored artists, and I admired her for that.
Is that a movement that's still happening in the States?
I don't think it's ever changed, has it? Really, the word movement is something that's often cropped up in my work or in my environment, because I certainly saw where we went into cities and created mass spaces, masses of spaces. You know, in Liverpool, we had over a period of 8 years, 25, 30 buildings. And I would sort of say that was a movement because it involved a lot of people. And I think movements are very much literally that following that physical meaning of the word is that it's moving an aspect of society into a more recognized level. Back in the 60s, we look back on it more and saw it as a movement. If you think of Liverpool, we worked up in Liverpool for quite a while. And if you think back to the 60s, where perhaps the Beatles were gigging and jamming in the forgotten warehouse districts around the Cavern area, subsequently now we look back on it and sort of say, but I'm not, you know, look what happened, but maybe at the time they didn't recognise that they were a movement.
Yeah. And did you find sort of established creative communities that were getting on with themselves that you could work with, or did you have to start from cold in places like Liverpool?
Well, we started in London by literally squatting a building, and
that was in Hampstead Heath, was it?
No. So we started the first one in Hampstead Heath. We were given. By Ken Campbell. Ken Campbell negotiated, the actor, performer, negotiated locally in Hampstead Heath to take over a short period the old ABC cinema. His daughter, Daisy Campbell, subsequently led a team of people, if that's a fair word. There are a lot of leaders, I guess. There are a lot of people to look at one of the spaces, and they created the temporary autonomous zone, which was a independent theatre space, I guess, really. Lots happening there. We looked at the next door cinema space and created a almost a white wall gallery. And literally by just opening the space, people appeared. And we followed that method in squatting a building in Leytonstow, 491 Gallery it became. And subsequently, over the 10 years, 8 years that it ran, maybe longer, thousands of people walked through those doors. Doors were open, thousands.
Within
a year, you know, it very quickly, it was not about us opening the space. It was about the people that were in there. And subsequently, we moved on from there to go up to Liverpool.
Really excellent. We just go back to the Hampstead Heath one for a bit. Okay, then move on to the Leytonstow thing in a mo. So you obtained basically a cinema. What sort of state was it in?
It was just literally derelict. The space we had still had all the seating in. I remember we took out all. It was due for demolition. It's now a Marks and Spencer's. If they're still there, I know that's what it was to become then. Other supermarkets are available, as they say.
Yeah.
But it was targeted for demolition, conversion to a supermarket. We knew we only had 6 months in there. And we literally had 5.5 months of ripping it out, painting it white, making it good, and then 2 weeks virtually of a party. And then it closed.
So it was bit of a warm-up act, really, that is. So what, okay.
It was an experience because we'd not done this before.
Yeah, no, and in a way, that sounds pretty ideal. There's some challenges with it, which I'll go to in a moment as well. But to actually have an opportunity to do your first project, see how it works, and then move on with all the lessons that you've got from that so that you can do the next one maybe a little bit better, perhaps. Was that an advantage, do you think, at that stage?
Yeah, I'd had a little bit of an insight. I bought a little bit of building knowledge. When I was running pubs, I'd actually ended sort of a 10-year career running pubs by converting a derelict building into a pub in Nottingham that still stands today as a pub. So I designed a concept. I employed a whole team of people through a job as a job. And we built from what was the original Nottingham Playhouse into a bar in Nottingham, which was then the Tivoli Beer Restaurant. So I had this knowledge of buildings. Combined with partners that I was working with and their interest in the arts and how they approach the space, we started to create quite a unique sort of aspect to a gallery space, almost 24-hour gallery, party performance space that many have popped up and will continue to pop up all over the country.
Okay, so it must have taken quite a lot of people quite a lot of time. There must have been a fair amount of materials involved as well, and all of these things require meaningless promissory tokens to some degree. How did you pull all of that together for just 6 months and then move on? What happens when you... Because this building, the ABC Cinema, was scheduled for demolition, became a Marks and Spencers. What happens at that move over point when the developer finally moves in on these temporary spaces that you've got? Do you see anything for all the effort you put in?
No, definitely not. And that's part of the problem of my long-term sustainability, I think, really, is the joy is the creation of the space, as always. The joy is creating the art. I'm not a person that wants to necessarily hold on to things myself. All of the buildings that we ran in the first 10 years of the art organization, in time, even those we had left, when we closed down the project, we gave them away to the people that were involved in the building. I'm not protective in that sort of sense. I understand development. I'm not against it. There's some very rotten buildings that unfortunately are in a rotten state, and sometimes the only answer is to knock them down. And that's a shame, and people might not like that idea, but believe me, when they've been in some of the buildings I have, you know, there's no curing dampness once it gets into a brickwork.
I had noticed that a lot of the buildings that are pictured on your website, which I put the link in the chat box, but it is www.howie-smith.org.uk. A lot of the buildings you're using are really quite handsome Victorian edifices, which I think you have to catch at the right time, don't you? They get to the point where they are rotten. Must be a difficult decision to make.
Well, like I say, that's not my decision. At the end of the day, I don't own them. And I'm not involved or influential at all on what a private landlord is doing with a building. It takes me enough to persuade them to let me use them. Mm-hmm. There's a big issue with obviously the drop in the economy in the last 5-8 years, maybe. There's a big issue with regeneration now. Changes in governments have seen infrastructures approach differently, banks and lending, etc., etc. So I sort of got why we got in a little bit of a stalemate. I understand why landlords are not so willing to take risk when at the end of the day they may not need to. So equally, I also don't blame city councils or authorities for not being able to predict, I guess, the economic problems that we got into. We saw cities come to a halt almost, and I think it's only now we're starting to turn it back. And we saw, I guess we were a good solution on some of the, I've really always been keen on targeting long-term derelict buildings. The worst that are perhaps on the market and that nobody knows what to do with. And if a building's got a sign on it and is lettable, then I'd prefer that someone goes and rents it. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily the ones I'm interested in. And then they turn out to obviously be the ones that have stood there the longest and therefore are potentially the most rotten as well.
Yeah. How do you get all the resource you need for doing a job like this? Because it's an expensive business fitting out an old, especially an old building. Do you recycle materials and get voluntary labour, or how's it work?
I think as I progress, every model has been different. If you think that what we're going to do is create an empty shell by creating a gallery space, normally initially at the beginning, if we were creating gallery spaces, that is an empty shell. And so we're able to then just rip out. We're not necessarily rebuilding. So the first approach would be to have, if a space is rotten inside, is to literally gut it out. Obviously, there's always a cost. In throughout this, I think as much as I run it as a social enterprise, I'd also like to think there's been a lot of philanthropic donation. Because I've got an interest, I see it as my art in creating spaces, and all artists should spend money or do typically spend money on their materials, and I see it as that. So if the cost is only to gut out and have skips or to send stuff to recycling, etc., then at least we're not having to buy new. But then obviously as I've progressed, I am keen in recycling. I do get buildings and rip out timber, for example, that's in a building and reuse all of it. I've reached the stage as well where I shop around and use timber yards, recycle timber yards and so on. But as the incomes, I will emphasize that where the first 10 years we had buildings and we passed them on, and we tried to use barter systems. So we had volunteers and groups that came in and took on buildings, and obviously put in the man hours and so on. subsequently, when I came to Nottingham and targeted it alongside the PhD, I didn't want to deal in free spaces. I felt that there's a worth to a space, and if a business is determined, then equally as I did, they will find a way to cost those initial startups. The offer that I can benefit them is the spaces that I'm creating can be as cheap as I can make them. So I'm not trying to profitize from them. But there is a cost to creating a space, and therefore that must be, you know, if you're to create a sustainable business, you must try and reimburse that cost. And so I rent spaces now, and then gradually as the rents increase and the more spaces that I've got, I've managed to obviously use that income to create the next space and the next space, so on.
So how many spaces are you actually running at the moment, and what's their kind of geographical spread?
I think I'm at 12. I'm negotiating at the moment. Mm-hmm. Negotiating four new spaces. I've got 9 in Nottingham, and 2 in Leicester.
Right.
So 9 that are active, and 1 that I'm building in Leicester, a vacant one in Leicester, and then I'm negotiating another 4 for next year.
Brilliant. That must be very exciting. I mean, you must find yourself personally kind of fairly consistently challenged financially, aren't you, doing this?
I am always challenged financially.
And do you find that, I mean, I'm constantly amazed by how synchronicity and chance puts things in my way that I really need and possibly couldn't otherwise afford. Do you find that's an important mechanism for you?
Well, I think, yes, I do. When I started my PhD, I was in a situation where I went to live in a caravan and I lived on a boat. So I took away my costs of living, and I don't mind denying, you know, when we started this, we squatted. We didn't have living costs. And I've always lived like that for a long, long time. And by taking the element of the need of money for myself, obviously I need to eat. I will put my hands up and support working tax credits at this point in today's debate about it, and happily admit how it's kept me alive with sort of £20 a week to feed myself with. Equally, I felt that, and I think most businessmen do, that when you start a business, you are normally the last person that gets paid.
Yeah, it can take a while, can't it?
It does, and you must reinvest in your business, in my belief, to make it work. Whether or not the rewards will come in the future, I mean, I see them in different ways, but certainly whilst I've been able to live cheaply and not want for much, then equally I don't mind. As I say, I mentioned earlier, being philanthropic and using as much and all of my money to reinvest it. You know, I'm trying to prove something. I'm trying to prove the argument that goes alongside my PhD. And that's, you know, that's worth investing in, I think.
Yeah. So what is the fundamental argument that runs alongside your PhD? That spaces need to be created and then left in these cities for people to use?
Well, we have different approaches, I think. One of the most recognisable one are that has happened in many cities for perhaps the last decade is this creative or cultural quarter approach, where there's some form of a public-private sector management team put into an area via the local authority to look at regeneration, to look at the creative industries. You know, there is a big economy behind the creative industries in the digital and the clean tech and the biosciences. Obviously, if we look at Nottingham has a current ongoing creative quarter strategy. Its target has been to regenerate a specific area and encourage new economies to move to the cities, students to stay in the city, etc. And obviously there's a lot of interest through university in these digitech industries. But of course, they're reliant on vibrant streets, life and soul, exciting events, continual galleries, music, etc., etc., which then reverts back to the painter and the sculptor and the music maker.
Who's got to be able to afford to be where they are?
Exactly, and then we talk into gentrification, etc., and certain classes being forced out to make way. You can look at San Francisco as a classic example of somewhere that a city that has been taken over by the digitech sort of industries.
This, of course, is one of the things that you point out, is that effectively as one new building arises, another one is rotting, so the city landscape's always changing and always offering new opportunities to you.
Exactly, and I'd like to just sort of think that I just sort of, you know, take this opportunity to sort of say out to those authorities, don't forget those forgotten arts, those arts that are being ignored, that are essential to the vibrancy of an area or of a city, you know, and include them in your strategies. And that's the little bit that I find that I'm managing to do, is I'm creating cheaper, affordable spaces, and encouraging very much more those arts. So in Leicester, we're building the first stages of, this is my latest project and perhaps the most challenging, but we're creating the first levels of a music college. So I'm going back to education and supporting people in Leicester, some groups of people in Leicester, by creating them a space there. But then in Nottingham last year, I focused very strongly on literature. We built space for the Five Leaves Bookshop, which is the first independent bookshop that we had in the city for 13 years. We built the Nottingham Writers Studio, which was a collective group that seen their membership treble by becoming a high street space. City Arts is a space that offers education to disadvantaged groups through the arts. So as I'm sort of progressing, I'm moving away from just creating cheap studio spaces, but now, you know, and creating such a diversity of spaces that target different types of people. And now, having gone through literature, looking at education, one of the new buildings that we're looking at is for education. But then I also want to target incubator retail spaces, because they're expensive. You know, what's on the high street now are very expensive. And if we can create smaller, cheaper, affordable retail, then it's just they're just little pockets. They're not effective, but as little examples, they're just trying to perhaps, you know, encourage the authorities that have got the strength and power to look at a city on a larger scale to maybe consider these options.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I mean, I think our best chance of changing things is to start providing a better example. I think that actually creating a bookshop, a space for a bookshop to exist, is in itself, you know, really applaudable activity, because I know they're disappearing. I personally love to shop in real bookshops rather than on Amazon. So has that got a kind of, has that got any security, the Five Leaves bookshop?
They're in the middle of the city centre. They're up an alleyway, so it was a space that nobody else wanted. But we've got a wonderful support, I think, in Nottingham of independent businesses, and it seems to be doing okay. And what has happened in the last year is there's been a very strong, push maybe of awareness of literature in the city. And now we're now actually bidding to be a city of literature. And the people leading that bid are the people involved in the Writers' Studio, the bookshop, and also a library, an old library, Victorian library, that's in the Bromley House Library, I think it's called.
So that shows quite a large spread, you know, from your first event where you spent 5 months building it, or 5 months and 2 weeks, and then 2 weeks in it, and now you've got something here that you set up and it's actually surviving, which I think is great. Yeah. It shows substantial progress, doesn't it?
Well, I'd like to think so, you know, and my hat's off to all those people that have had a go at setting up those businesses in those spaces. You know, they are, you know, I guess in any point, once the landlord's getting the money he wants, and as long as he gets it, then there's no reason to get rid. So unless you're in San Francisco, and obviously if you can get rid of what's cheap, then you can put in someone expensive.
Yeah, but, you know, which of course is
gentrification's not quite affecting cities as much as what people might think.
Right, that might be a change as well, because I know when I was living in Oxford, I saw that happen in Jericho, which was a lovely place that was full of students, and a boatyard and things like that. But it did eventually slowly but surely get, because the creatives and students were there, it got more and more expensive, until now it's quite an upmarket area. It's a kind of churn, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm not denying it's not happened, because of course it has happened. But if we look at Nottingham now, in their new push, the prices aren't going, we're not gentrifying again, if that's what I guess I mean.
Yeah. So you're...
We're already gentrified. Gentrified in the 90s when we converted industrial units to usable spaces. We're not converting them again, so to speak.
Because I know you saw that happen with the Lace Market in Nottingham, didn't you? Which I remember being a pretty spectacular space when I was up there as a lad. Although I don't think it was being used for anything. I can't really remember. But did you work on that alone, or were you working on it with the authorities of the city, or what?
I'd like to, you know, hats off to our city council. I do like our city council. Obviously I deal with individuals. I wouldn't like to say that I like their policies necessarily on everything, or some of the ways that they go about doing things and some of the length of times they take to do it. But when you're dealing with an individual, you know, at the end of the day, I see them as individuals, and I've managed to create up a good relationship, I think, with a few of the people that are relevant to regeneration, I guess, in the city. And they care. I think the ones I deal with seem to care. They want the best for the city. Obviously, structure in authority always slows down process. And that's part of what I'm challenging as a PhD student, is to look at your structure a little bit different and to think a bit different. But they're coming on board my project. They've been on board it for quite a few years. They've been supportive on business rates, where I'm entitled to exemptions. And equally, they're now coming on board with buildings. So where I'm negotiating for new spaces now, I'm actually looking at a couple of spaces that the City Council own in Nottingham that have been empty for a long time, and they just don't know what to do with them.
So do you think your steady and a committed self-sacrifice is actually slowly but surely changing the habits of mind in the council?
I think it goes back to what I said right at the beginning. You know, is it in time, like if we compared where we compared to Liverpool, at time, these little anarchistic artists that were popping up in derelict spaces became the Beatles and became Jerry and the Pacemakers and Cilla Black and etc. And in time, we go, wow, they're the best in what they do. I think in time, you can look at a lot of examples of where the alternate has eventually influenced the authorities to try it, to accept it, and fit it into their system.
I think really that's, in my opinion, one of our best ways forward is to make energetic and exemplary progress in the other direction, as it were, and replace what is not working properly with stuff that is.
Yeah, well, if they've got no answers, I've got some. To listen, and I guess what I am finding, obviously, as well as when I deal with authorities, is that I'm having to prove myself a little bit more, not just in the fact that they can look at a portfolio of maybe 25, 30, 35 buildings that's been achieved, but equally there's always a level of paperwork that goes with it as well.
Yeah, so, how do you find the admin? There must be an awful lot of that doing what you're doing.
Well, this is becoming new. This is obviously, it's important to me to understand it, because if I'm to write the template that others can follow, then the more I can learn and find ways through the admin, then the better, or the more beneficial for the future. So I don't mind doing it. I've always felt that I'm a bit of a puzzle solver, and a problem solver, etc. And I enjoyed the challenge of that. And so equally, I think I'm sort of accepting it. And my knowledge base is amazing. We're building a music school in Leicester, where I've had to literally learn the whole aspects of soundproofing and talk to so many experts to understand it, to hope to build it. It's a wonderful knowledge base as well.
So what sort of building are you putting that in?
It's an old pub. It's an old, what is the chain, Australian chain. I shan't advertise. I don't think it's worth it. But it was an old pub that I've had for about 5 or 8 years. And in Leicester, and I've tried 3 different approaches to let local communities use it as a community space. And despite, I think, all efforts, I couldn't find a long-term sustainability in that method.
Yeah.
So we approached it completely different, where I've actually, for the first time, I've gone out, I've looked for investment into a property because it's sort of a beyond my budget. And hopefully we can actually create a lovely performance space, rehearsal rooms over 2 floors, lecture room, IT room, et cetera, et cetera.
That's absolutely fabulous. And what sort of longevity do you anticipate that project will have?
Well, I mean, initially we've got a 5-year period to approach it. I'd like to think, again, once we're paying the rent to the landlord, there's no reason to change it. And if the model is successful, which you can look in other cities where it has been, Leicester doesn't have what it's building. It's affiliated to a university. It's going to offer degree level education from next year in business, in music education and business. So I think and we're linking with it small incubator spaces. So even look at the following graduation, that there's little spaces you can occupy to further your career, etc.
I mean, that's a massive project.
Absolutely, it's beyond anything that I might have perceived 15 years ago.
Yeah,
it's challenging, but equally, like I say, hey, talk to me about soundproofing.
I guess you learn something new with every single project you do, don't you?
You do. Yeah, because as I say, they're all different. So they're all different, and on purposefully, I suppose. as an artist, I guess part of being that creative mind is repetition doesn't always work.
No, and it gets boring, doesn't it? And I mean, I think that as well, as you develop each individual project and move on, there's a tendency for the new project to challenge the tools you've got to the max and force you to learn new stuff effectively.
Yeah.
I see, artist formerly known as Graham has put in the chat box, took me 2 weeks putting up my garden shed, may need a few tips.
Yeah, well, there you go.
So
with artists, working with artists is that everyone, they all know what to do with their hands.
Yeah, do you find it easy to get people involved? Because that must be one. I mean, I know you can reduce material costs maybe by 50% by rehashing and upcycling and all of that, but always I find the major cost in these things is the labor. Do you find people willing to join in? Do you find the people you need arriving when you need them?
Yeah, I don't follow that approach so much anymore. It is a hard working as with a volunteer base is a lot slower, I guess, really, if it's to be fair.
So you prefer to pay, do you?
Yeah, I have a dedicated team of builders that I've known for a long time in the city. And they worked with me on that first build when we built the bar back in 1994, something like that.
Another great advantage, I guess, is in your perseverance is that you've presumably got quite an excellent team all round now, haven't you?
Yeah, like I say, yeah, I've got you know all the building skills that are at hand to do a proper professional job. And that's required now. I can't build a music school, I don't think, with a bunch of volunteers. With respect to those volunteers.
No, I know what you mean. We garden with volunteers, and even with relatively simple tasks, it is necessary to be paying quite a lot of attention. And, you know, a mistake in a garden's one thing, a mistake in rebuilding a building is quite another.
Exactly. I'd like to think I can put my hand to anything. And I can virtually build anything, but I certainly can't build it as well as my builders can.
No. So you're, by the sound of it, your techniques have changed really quite substantially, because that building in Leytonstow that you moved to from the Hampstead Heath gig, I think, was it a, it was left over from road construction of some sort?
Yeah, the A12 construction. I think it had been squatted when they did that originally. It was the one building that was left about when they knocked down a whole artist community to put the A12 through it.
They knocked down an artist community and you squatted it and started building another one. Well done, mate.
Well, it was funny. Yeah, I think that's the inspiration in itself, if we just think of that story.
And has the change, the change in the squatting legislation presumably has made that kind of approach a lot more difficult, has it?
I don't know. I don't get involved with squatting anymore. But what I did see was that there has been a lot more since 2000. And I'm not saying it wasn't, I'd say this has been going on from the 60s. But when we were in London in 2000, I know from that project that there were, I can think of half a dozen people that perhaps went on and got their own spaces. And there was a little explosion, I think, at that time. And what we did in squatting the building is we started negotiating with the landlord next door. We obtained the property next door by a legal agreement. Peppercorn rent, and that introduction for me was what allowed us to progress and go up to Liverpool, because we started negotiating, so we weren't squatting.
Right, and did you find that the contacts in one city helped you when you got up to Liverpool?
Yeah, I think especially when I remember we negotiated for 3.5 years at Leytonstow to not pay business rates. We claimed we didn't need to as a non-profit group. We ticked a box that they stated as a non-profit group we didn't have to pay it, but for 3.5 years they argued with us, and I stuck by my guns on it, and eventually they agreed that we didn't have to. And once we got that agreement, I was able to go up to another city and sort of say, hey, look, that's what they're doing over there. Here. And now I have those conversations before I even begin to think about buildings.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Yeah, I can... Yeah, I can quite see that.
I think at the end of the day, it's that little bit of saying, you join in this project. I don't have to come here and do this. But if you want your high street improved, if you want, then you've got to play a little part as well.
And you've got a hell of a slate to show them that it works.
Well, exactly. And yes, I don't want to be there getting something free from it forever. I never do. And I pay rents to landlords, and I am quite happy to, but what I think projects need is they need that little boost. It was all well and good when Big Society came forward, David Cameron came forward and said, you on the, can go and take over that building on the corner of a street and open a free school. But there was no reality into how someone could achieve that, because the moment you open the doors, you are running up a cost.
Yeah.
And if all your money, if the first bit of your money is paid to a utility company, for example, to reconnect electrics, or to a local authority to pay your business rates, then you do not have money to put into the building itself. And that should be the priority.
So how your battle for the business rates, was that 3.5 years in the courts, or did you manage it using your personal relationships?
I offered to go to court continually, and that was my argument, I guess, really, is I was sort of saying, well, look, send me to court, we'll argue it there, this is what the government says, and you as a local authority are not doing that. And at the end of the day, it was about, at the time, local authorities catching up with what government were trying to be supportive of, I think, at the time, with offering a business rates exemption to non-profit groups.
Yeah, and what about the utilities? Do you manage to negotiate with them as well? Because
I will always continue to say that they are perhaps the worst people that I could ever deal with.
Yeah. So we can quite see that.
There's no identity to them. No one, you know, you're dealing with stakeholders or shareholders or whatever that. you know, everyone is in a job. The at the end of the day, you know, 3 months later, they're in another job, you know, and you're dealing with someone else. And there's a big turnover of staff. No one, I don't, you know, it's okay saying sorry over a phone, but unless you mean it, you're just saying it purely out of politeness.
So you find there's actually little room for negotiation with them, whereas you are getting results with the councils. That's interesting.
I'll tell you one of the best things I've seen on utility companies, and I'm big up Nottingham on it, is that Nottingham has just become a supplier of energy through their old local authority, and they're using energy that goes through incineration, which isn't necessarily a good thing, but and I think we have some sort of underground heating thing as well going on. I'm not 100% sure how it's working. Mm-hmm. But hopefully we're now a supplier, and obviously profits from it go back into local authority.
Okay, that's an interesting manoeuvre as well.
Well, it's a really interesting one. It's something that sort of, I guess, that Jeremy Corbyn's been hitting upon in his talking. Obviously, we've got a Labour local council, and it basically means that money is not going to shareholders of the big six companies.
Yes, indeed, yeah, who are themselves, of course, a complete fraud.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be a future. I know Nottingham's the first to have done it. It won't be long before all the other cities follow.
That's interesting, isn't it? That's a very interesting movement indeed. We've got a question in the chat box from Nick Nomic, the man who thanks Nick for doing the show before mine, as ever. And he's put, has the guest ever considered having a community radio, even for a couple of hours a week? And our main admin said, would you like a slot? You're going down well in the chat box, sir.
So what's that, to actually set up a community radio?
Yeah, because it's easily done, you know, I just do it off my laptop here.
Oh yeah, we've got a few in Nottingham. I've played around on guesting on a few because they're run by people I know.
Great, well, it'd be nice to have some links to that because I'm always interested in hearing new internet radio stations myself.
NG Digital, there's a little gang of them, Jason... Darren, Mick, a few others. I'm not from London, or are promoters in Nottingham involved with them. They're streaming live gigs now. They're podcasting, etc., and really doing a lot for the local Nottingham music scene.
Absolutely brilliant. So the your Leytonstow thing turned out to be a really real success, as far as I can gather. It lasted for 10 years, maybe a bit more. You had a gallery there. You're having events and thousands of people through the doors, and also the possibility of kind of birthing art projects. Did anybody come out of there who sort of got the chance to start in a kind of relatively free and easy way and is still making a business out of what they started there, do you know?
Well, as I say, part of that first building in Hampstead Heath was negotiated by Ken Campbell. Ken Campbell has had he's passed on now, but has had a fantastic history in the arts and performance, etc. His daughter Daisy has gone on to do some wonderful things with 24-hour theatre and some different experiences. And if I can remember sort of names that were knocking around there, I think at the time they were just people that were coming to events. It was very strongly around the St. Mary's College and the Performance University, if I remember, down in what it's called in London. And there are certainly were faces there that that have gone on to great things in different bands. I remember meeting people that have since become famous.
Brilliant. So it's actually having quite an impact, isn't it, this project, really, over time, bit by bit, as you build your teams. And it seems to me that a lot of it's really down to the personal relationships you're setting up with the individuals that you need to set them up with. So you're sort of doing the human end of the legislation, really, aren't you? Trying to get much of it done heart to heart and eyeball to eyeball rather than paperwork to paperwork.
Yeah, I think everyone's got a different story, haven't they? And if you don't listen to the story, then you can't really adjust to work with it. Mm. You know, if you, especially now that I'm creating spaces for people, for organisations, for groups of people, then it's important that I create something that they want, that they need. And therefore, you know, last year we it was more the people come, the people tend to come first almost now. Is I get approached through my history of the art organization quite often, at least once a month, there's someone from another city will email saying, oh, I've seen the stuff that you did for the art organization, or they're in Liverpool now or whatever, even though I'm not. And obviously locally in Nottingham, there's a wonderful community of artists here. And fortunately, you know, I've been around this city for a long time and quite a lot of people know me. So people come to me and sort of tell me what they need. And that allows me to potentially target a space. Mm.
So to start with, you were pretty much having to make it up, and now you're getting a bit of a feedback loop.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, it's beneficial. It's beneficial. Mm. You know, and it's getting more diverse. You know, I'm looking at potentials next year that could look into other parts of the Nottingham districts, other small towns, suburbs. There's a project in the north of the city that's looking at opportunities for young people in our suburbs, Nottingham suburbs, the Borwell district, etc. I think it's something like this is the ninth worst, I don't know, opportunistic, whatever the label they've given it in the country. But in potentially it's the largest housing estate out of Glasgow. So, and there's nothing in it. There's no, it's just houses. So, you know, just the whole northwest of a city is just one big housing estate with a few high streets in it with empty vacant spaces. Mm. No employment within it. There's nothing, there's no opportunity. There's a college there. They're investing in the college, and equally they're running a project. This is an authority. This is through Graham Allen, who's an MP for that area. Equally, I kind of like that. You know, it's like, well, you know, this is where we're at now. It doesn't matter how we've got here. If I can do something out there and look at spaces out there that create opportunity. Mm. And that's what it's all about, isn't it? It's just trying to.
It's really great, actually, seeing other people's liabilities as an opportunity. I think that's a really good way of starting to turn the situation around. We'll have a quick question from Nick Nomic in the chat box, and then we'll stop for a music break, shall we? Because time's flying by, as usual.
And we said we'd have nothing to talk about.
Oh, I could tell just by looking at your website that there was plenty for us to get our teeth into. Nick's asking whether, as this work is likely educational, have you ever tried, when dealing with officials, saying that it's charitable work rather than just not-for-profit? Have you considered the difference between those two approaches? I guess you have.
Well, yeah. When we ran the art organisation ran as a non-profit. So we, you know, I'll share this info that we did it as, and it's not always the only way to do it. But we set up as a private limited company. We had no incomes or outgoings. We covered out of our own pocket things like website costs and public liability insurance at the time to make sure that everyone in the building was safe and covered. Mm-hmm. And apart from that, we didn't transact in money. So we didn't really, you know, there was no profit to be made. And that's how I perceived non-profit. We looked at the art organisation after 10 years and looked at it to go into charitable status. And we made the application, and Charity Board turned it down on a basis that the spaces that we created, people made money within them for themselves.
Like the charities don't.
There's some very sceptical charities, I think, in this world.
Yeah.
So it wasn't necessarily and I think the structures of non-profit, social enterprise, charities, ethical business, cooperatives, I don't think they're strong enough in this country.
No, when I looked into them, it seemed to me that only the cooperative was still a workable structure, really. Although non-registered charity also seems to have some advantages.
Yeah, I think there should be a stronger legislation or whatever word they use it to define what is what, and therefore what should be entitled to what. I think that charities, there's some charities that we saw about this kids charity, didn't we, that has shown the potentially there's been some sort of, I don't know, I'm not going to say because don't want to become liable for anything, but there's something not quite right.
Yeah,
there's something not quite right. Certainly, I think what came to the forefront that it was being supported by government. And subsequently I questioned why. And subsequently I also think that there's a lot of big spending by the Fat Cat of charities.
Yeah. Actually, we've got one more question, which is apposite, that's come up in the chat box from Starfall. She says, how do you resolve dealing with European funding initiatives? Is that a consideration as a means of financing the project? Well, I don't think you go for grants, do you? You manage it all from the ground, as far as I gather.
No, to date, I have not applied for funding.
Well done.
And I won't, and certainly what we're looking at in Leicester, as I say there, I've looked at different sources of investment.
You're kind of looking for philanthropic investment and stuff there, aren't you?
Investment, well, some philanthropic, some that gets a return, some that the other approach is obviously, now that I am talking to councils on a little bit stronger thing, is whether or not they can support and fund projects equally, where their budgets lie, where they might have money from ERDF funding or whatever, and it's targeted for specific things. These are early days, yeah. I've never, ever been dismissive of funding. I just never have wanted to do it before.
No, I think that's really good, because an application, as we know, is basically a begging letter, and with any benefit come duties and responsibilities, and it sounds like you've got quite enough duties and responsibilities as it is.
Well, I think so, and as I say, I don't think I tick enough boxes. I've never ticked the right boxes, and I don't think there's ever really been money for regen. There certainly has been on big scales. But there's very, you know, very small scales. You might think about things like the Esme Fairbairn or Unlimited or something like that. But, you know, you've got to tick all their boxes, and then you've got to apply by their rules to follow what you're doing. And I've never wanted to do that.
No.
You know, so equally, you know, I've never bothered to date.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's going...
against it, because I'm aware that a lot of people seek it out and achieve a lot with it, you know?
Yeah. So at the same time, I think you maintain a fair degree more editorial control if you're managing as much as possible to maintain control of the stream of promissory tokens.
Yeah, I think so. I think I've got my team of builders. For example, if I'm to go for funding, then I would have to go through a methodology of tendering and procurement.
Mm. Oh, I've been through that. It's a nightmare.
That would mean that potentially I'm not using my team of builders. And I trust my team of builders. They're important to me. Mm. You know, let's say I've built up a team over a lot of years. That's important. So if I was to go through another route through funding, then I would have to question I'd have to tender out my work and make that work available to everyone or anyone. And that's something I don't want. It's my business, you know, so yeah. I'd ended up to run my business as efficiently and as quickly and smoothly and as affordable as I can.
Yeah. Yeah, Jason's put in the chat box, asking for funding is externalising power. You're remaining in complete control. Brilliant, he says, which is pretty much what I think's going on as well. Well, I'll tell you what, we've chatted for over an hour or so, I'll put on two or three tunes, 10 minutes of music or so, and we'll have a wee break if that's all right with you. Is that all right with you?
Yeah, I'll power up my phone a little, give me a chance to plug in my phone.
Very good, excellent stuff. Well, if you join us again in sort of 8 or 10 minutes or so, or as soon as you can, I'll put on some tunes for the people, and we'll catch up with you again. You're of course listening to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com, where we're talking with Robert Howie Smith about taking over disused industrial buildings and using them to create creative spaces for creative people. And here's Souljacker from the Eels. There we go. That was Chris Rea and the Road to Hell after Kidnap Alice and Going Where the Chilly Winds Don't Blow. A bit of unexpected irony there. Now we welcome back this evening's guest, Robert Howie Smith. You still with us, Robert? I'm sorry that I have to apologise to you, Rob, and to the folk out in the chat box because I failed to unmute your mic there. I've only been doing this for 4 years and I still have problems with the few buttons I've got to press. So I'm sorry about that. It's just my way of proving that it's live music. Oh, so we were just saying that basically your project, having started with nothing, is kind of rolling along on the rents and stuff of the buildings that you're now running. So you've presumably got a bit of cash flow, but my guess is you're always pretty close to the edge, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I spend it every year. So anything I make goes.
I suppose that's what not-for-profit means, eh?
I'll be honest, I follow the guys under the Howie Smith Project as a social enterprise. It's targeted to make a profit and to reinvest the profit. In the 3 years, I haven't paid myself. And whether I will, like I say, I hope to. And we're hoping to look at it this year.
15 years down the line.
Well, I just sort of think that, you know, like I say, you need to spend it to make it, if it's to be long term. And that's the important thing first, is to make it sustainable. I can't get rich, for example, off one thing. It's got to, and I'm not, don't think I'll ever be rich, but you need multiples of lots of little things, you know, otherwise I've got to charge big rents, which is then I'm just doing what everyone else is doing.
I think we're making a fundamental point about the thing that we're treating as currency as well, which is that it's an energy transfer, and that bunging it in a bank somewhere is not going to be anything like as useful as putting it back out into the economy and making things happen with it. Well, economy, I use the word loosely.
Yeah, and I think, you know, if I take myself out of the equation, you know, I'm pretty sure that when I have my PhD, when I'm a bit older and this becomes a bit more settled, it will look after me. Mm-hmm. But I think at the moment, while it's not so important, then what is important is I think just playing my part in something I believe in.
Yeah. And of course, I guess being an artist, you can actually see and appreciate the benefits to other people. And I mean, as an artist, your art is entirely in creating the spaces, is it? Do you do any other sort?
No, not at all. As an artist, I create exhibitions that support wildlife and conservation. As a digression, I'm trustee for the Wolves and Humans Foundation, which is a charity based in England that supports environmental concerns towards wildlife predators, mostly in Europe, because we have very few in this country. As trustee, I've worked with them to encourage. I create exhibitions that can be supportive of them. We've just done a tour up in Scotland where we went round and talked about the reality of wolves in the environment, taking some of the scientists that we support in Slovakia and Poland through the charity. We brought them over to England. We took part in a conference up in Edinburgh and then went on the road to little village halls around the Highlands and brought some reality of what it's like living with wolves to the Scottish Highlands, where potentially it has and will maybe for a long while yet still be discussed. But I'm very supportive through that, and subsequently focus my art mostly wolf-related.
Very good. Yeah, I always like to recommend, when people mention wolves, a YouTube video I saw called How Wolves Change Rivers, which is...
Yeah, indeed. Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely fabulous little video. It's really nice to see some upbeat stuff on YouTube, and that was one of my favourites, really, because the introduction of a few wolves seemed to have completely transformed the kind of ecosphere there.
Yeah, alongside a lot of other things.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. The balance, it's about balance, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't matter whether we talk about human society or wolf society. Or wilderness, it's about the balance. And with wolves there's less deer, there's less, therefore other animals come through because trees grow and foliage and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and the deer won't go to places where they're going to get trapped by the wolves.
Not at all, not at all. So you know, it is about the balance, you know, I think that's something that I think I follow in both.
Seems to me to be you've been learning some good examples from that as well, because you're basically working in an area where you could easily be had by wolves and you're surviving quite nicely by the sound of it.
Well, a lot of the storytelling that relates to my wolf work is about that aspect of human society that is also relevant to how humans have treated wolves in the past and the aspect of wolf society. I was always in my talk that I did when I was up in Scotland, one point that I made was remembering when a story that I heard when someone said that potentially human society copied and watched the wolf as we developed as humans, and therefore in our society we have a similar balance. We have the parents and the siblings and the aunts and the uncles and the teachers and the pathfinders and so on and so forth. And human society and wolf society is structured very, very similarly.
And we don't seem to really recognise that in our own society, do we? Don't necessarily recognise that there are places where people are essential that some people might not recognise as essential, at least in the wolves. There's, I guess it's part of the divide and conquer techniques that are being practiced upon us. You wouldn't get a lot of that happening in wolf packs.
Within the pack themselves, obviously not. There's always going to be a hierarchy, and it's mostly based on a family. When wolves come against wolves, we could compare that to atrocities in our world today, couldn't we?
Yeah, I guess so. So to return to the building projects, you were saying before our music break that you don't have anything more to do with the squatting movement necessarily, which is how the Leytonstone thing was established. And I remember when I saw you at the Fire in the Mountain, you said that you were establishing different methodologies basically to turn these spaces into you know, affordable, cheap and sometimes free spaces. So what sort of, when you start now with a project, rather than squatting it, what's your first move?
Okay, so if I, I guess it varies on two fronts, is that if I have someone that wants a space, then I'm looking for that space, that might suit them. If at the moment where I'm wanting to show some little templates of affordable retail, I have no idea who might want to take retail space at this moment. So if there's anyone listening in Nottingham that might want a small retail space, here's a good opportunity to start advertising it. But what I think is an affordable amount, I think if I create it, then I will hope, almost going back to that beginning approach, if I open the doors on something, someone will come along and want it. And that's my sort of hope at the moment.
Yes, I think those two things are quite important. The one thing is spending your money as it arrives, because it kind of demonstrates where your intent is and spirit, or whatever we want to call it, understands what you're trying to do. But the other thing is that by creating a space, you're making a kind of vacuum which is going to pull people in. And I guess then it kind of takes... its own form, does it? You know, you're there as a kind of guiding principle, but presumably each project develops depending on who it is that turns up to help.
Well, exactly. I mean, there's one aspect, you know, something I said earlier was that I target the long-term derelict buildings. Now, they're not all in a neat row in the middle of a city centre, all sort of like saying, come take me. You know, they're sat on the fringes where there are no footfalls, where there are potentially, you can't just pop a cafe anywhere and say and hope people will come to you. You know, a cafe will target somewhere where there are potentially already people. So when you open a building that's on the fringe of a city and in a derelict area, in a forgotten area, then you've got to try and bring a footfall to it. An example being that we talked about the bookshop being up an alleyway. No one will walk up an alleyway unless there's something at the top there that attracts them. How they get to know it's there is obviously down to marketing of that shop or of that business or whatever. So the advantages I've looked at, where we talked about the Nottingham Writers Studio. Nottingham Writers Studio had X amount of members. They've now tripled, I think, their amount of membership. I hope I'm right in saying that. And what they've done is they were in an area that was in a little bit of a void between the Lace Market area and Snent Market area. There was a bit of a void street in Hockley, and by putting in the Writers Studio, then weekly we get 300 people walking down that street now. Next door to it, two doors up, sorry, we put City Arts, which cater for last year 21,000 users to their services that they provided in education in the arts. That's 21,000 people that are potentially walking into that area over the next year, maybe more, because they're in a much more prominent space and central to the city, enough to serve the whole city. So they were specifically put there, in my mind, to put a footfall in that then might encourage businesses to open up around it.
And you've actually managed to put a couple of things together that are kind it's of complementary, as it were.
Yeah. Complementary. So it's a small example of what a large authority might do in putting a big gallery in the middle of a city centre. And you can think about, you know, in Nottingham, we built Nottingham Contemporary. It's seen as a catalyst to encourage other things to build up around it. There's examples all over the world. And yeah. I did that on a small scale, just to be a template within my PhD.
Mm. Have you got a lot of experience of what's going on around the world in this sort of area?
Well, I certainly looked at San Francisco. I looked at what gentrification actually achieves on a city 20 years later. If you can think, you know, that might be one of the first that began to target the creative industries because of its bohemian approach to the arts, you know, back in the days of Kerouac, you know. Now sort of 20, 30 years later, you know, it's completely gentrified and the smaller community groups have been forced across the water. So that was interesting to go and look at the end result of a strategy that brought about gentrification and subsequently, well, let's be honest, destroyed an element of culture within a city.
And did you learn anything from there which helped you out, say, when you got to Liverpool?
Well, no, that was a recent trip, I think, really. That when I went to Liverpool, I guess that those were the learning days. So I certainly wasn't approaching what I did then in the same line as what I do now.
I mean, that's a pretty, you were saying earlier on that at one stage you had sort of 25 or 30 buildings that you were running in Liverpool. I mean, that...
Not all at the same time, I think over about an 8-year period.
Okay, so how many are you juggling at any one period, do you think? Well, were you up there?
Say that line again, sorry.
How many were you juggling at any one time in Liverpool in your learning stage?
I think as a management front, you know, if I was involved in any aspect of their management, and there was a good team of core people up there, you know, and I'll sort of say hi to Greg and Steve and Mike, Becky, who I recall, Jerry. There were some lovely people that you know, were really fundamental to that project happening. But subsequently, you know, you freed up a space and it was the people that did something in the space that ultimately managed it. So I didn't necessarily have to juggle a lot myself. You know, there were other people alongside me. I tended to get wrapped into the organisation of the buildings and the project, etc., freeing up other artistic things at a time for other people. We were all good at recognising each other's talents, so it never felt that it was juggling too much. And then equally, as it progressed, I almost backed off Liverpool once it got on a flow and came down to Nottingham.
Right.
And just used to pop up. So after about 4 or 5 years, just used to pop up. What was interesting, I think, with Liverpool, I remember when we turned up there, I think we had about 12 buildings at the same time. And we went there as part of the biennial in 2004. There was loads of us. We just went up there and swamped into 12 buildings. I think there were 40 odd people, and put on this little, more for ourselves, I think, really, than anything else, put on this little fringe quarter of the biennial that was going on all over the city at the time. And what I thought was most impressive is I think it was 2008 in the City of Culture year that we actually, the buildings that we occupied then actually took up a quarter section of the booklet of the Liverpool Biennial.
Very good. That must have been exciting.
Yeah, and I think that was a little bit of sort of that what I was saying earlier, that we turned up there as these anarchistic, artistic idiots or whatever that had come up from London. Because that's where we were based at the time, although none of us were really from London. Equally, you know, 6 years later, 4 years later, sorry, we were actually, or three biennials later, we were accepted and promoted as part of the biennial.
Excellent.
And by then it was all the Liverpool people. It wasn't the London people. Mm. By then it was Liverpool people. The London people came, they went, the spaces were there. That was when we started to open up to local people to sort of say, look, these spaces are for you. There's only two of us really at the time, or three of us. This is for you. And that was when Liverpool sort of took over, the local people took over.
And did that have the kind of momentum, sufficient momentum to keep it running, say, to this day? Is it? It's still kind of.
A lot of the buildings. I'd like to sort of say, we talked about gentrification. I think what we did in Liverpool was, in essence, we slowed down, or we helped to slow down gentrification. I think there was a lot of politics up there when we turned up there. The area that we worked in the rope walks they'd built FACT. And they'd built, the authorities had built the building next to it, the old tea factory or something they called it, and created spaces for those creative industries. But the majority of the buildings at the time were privately owned and therefore not available to the city council to further their cultural quarter strategy at the time. And I think it kind of, to be fair to them, not rude to them, but it kind of fell flat. And those private landlords were the ones that we dealt with. And so, in essence, independently, we almost think created a little creative quarter. Those buildings, because of, again, whatever reasons, got changed hands from the landlords we dealt with to other landlords over a period of time. Some of the businesses were that when we closed the art organisation in 2010, we were able to negotiate those spaces for then direct discussion with the landlords that owned them. And whether they've continued, I pop up to Liverpool every now and then, but I can't remember who's doing what up there at the moment.
By and large, you're finding that that if you give people the opportunity, I guess you basically find that they sort of grow into the challenges of the project. And also, it sounds like rather than having one leader, you've got several. You've got people who are recognised as being good at what they do, and that's what they do. So you've actually got a team of people, if you like, rather than just one visionary telling shed loads of other people what to do.
Yeah, I don't think I'm that sort of person. I don't think to ever be able to dictate anything. And it's people have their own direction that they want to go in, and if you allow that determination to follow through, then let them get on with it. I find it hard enough just to manage myself half the time, so let alone anything else.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I bet you're kept well busy.
Yeah. Well, I say it's especially with studies at the moment. There's no such thing as anything, but this is my life and my lifestyle.
And so, you're basically your contacts, your methods, your practice, and all of that is clearly now making it a bit easier for you to get hold of buildings. Are you getting a larger choice of buildings to work from as well?
The last one, the ones that we're talking about now, is I looked at the city where we have got some empty buildings. Obviously, there are, as much as we have a creative quarter push, and we've had little pushes, Nottingham has still got quite a few pockets that have got some large buildings in them that have been there for quite a while. So I'm sort of where I started across the road in the Station Street area, across the road from the train station, buildings that had been derelict at the time for about 12 years. I then went over to just before the Creative Quarter strategy and developed a building that had been empty for 20 years and then sort of joined in what the Creative Quarter are trying to do in regenerating and looked at the periphery of some of the areas that their ERDF funding has regenerated. Now it's sort of like said, well, that's full on with the Creative Quarter. Let's go and have a look at another part of the city. So we're going to go over towards the canal and look at some large buildings down there.
Excellent stuff. And
that's if you all know Nottingham. And if you don't, please pop down and you can come and have a look. Come visit.
It's a lovely city, Nottingham. I haven't been there for ages, but it's got a lot of... one of the things I remember about it is it's got quite a few pretty ancient pubs in it.
We have. I think Nottingham... I like having grown up here, except it's a long way from the sea.
It is a long way from the sea and Leicester. You know, if you want to move from Nottingham...
You can't get further from the sea bar Nottingham and Leicester.
No.
I've always liked growing up here. I've liked it for its diversity. And I think now there is a great excitement in the city. There's an energy that I feel has picked up. We are getting good press nationally. And there are some pioneering initiatives that I kind of like. From the top down or even from the bottom up, there's things I like. There's a big focus on renewable energies and studies of that. That's something I'm a big fan of and I want to include more in buildings that I do in the future. I think it's just well placed. I'm just well placed to be in the city that I grew up with at a time that it's quite vibrant and exciting.
Yes, indeed, and it sounds like you went away from home in order to return, which is something I've heard in a lot of places, go and get a bit of experience elsewhere, but ultimately it's your own community that's the best place for you to be pulling things like this off.
Yeah, it helps. It helps having a long history in the city and knowing a lot of people.
Yeah.
My mother's still here, and it's nice to be close to her. And equally, I think, I don't know, you get more patriotic, I think, as you get older.
I think also you're kind of getting in with the people, aren't you? You know, you understand the administration and you're dealing with the men and women that are running it and all that kind of stuff. It's that, more than anything else, I suspect, is what's getting things done.
I think so, yeah. I do think that within our city, and I'd like to think in every city, it's what I said earlier, that these are people, everyone that is a person, and I think that I know that our authority leaders and our councillors, etc., mingle with people and seriously talk to people and try to take on board what's being said. And you can meet them in social settings as much. You can meet them walking down the street. And they'll start, you know, you can stop and you can have a chat in the middle of the street if you see them, sort of thing. And I find, you know, the people I deal with are friendly people, you know, and it's not us or them. I firmly believe that it's we're all in this boat at the moment. And personally, I think that we all know that. I don't know whether we can say the same thing for the echelons of government. I don't know.
The thing, like I say, is dealing heart to heart with actual individuals. And I mean, you know, at that point, if it's you, Robert Howie Smith, dealing with whoever a planning officer is or whatever, then it's two men or a man and a woman dealing with each other. And in a way, perhaps the role, the office, the nature of the authority is not quite so important when you've got that kind of human empathy, I guess, when you've got an actual human relationship driving things rather than, I don't know, a relationship between a slave and somebody who tells the slave what to do.
Well, it's almost all that computer says no type.
Yeah.
You know, is I think you've just got the, if you can present to someone who is in authority of something that is not right, and they're, and you can prove it, and they're not intelligent enough to recognise that, then that's just being arrogant and stupid, isn't it? In my mind. So if you present something that has strength, and I think what I'm doing now has proven itself, that we have a problem with empty vacant properties in this city, and I can provide a solution, and you must listen. And I think, and I've not said it in that direct tone, what I've done for 15 years is build examples. And therefore I don't even have to say it. I said, look, here's a solution.
By their deeds shall ye know them.
Yeah, and if I can write, if I can then prove this with the writing of academics, which is, let's be honest, what all policies that governments follow are written by academics saying, questioning one policy beforehand. This is not right. We should do it this way. This is not right. We should do it that way. You know, and that's how, and it's a sad state of, I personally think it's a sad state of how it all works.
That's a very, very interesting point, though. I mean, do you find they respond well to that kind of treatment? You know,
this is perhaps the first time I'm verbalising. This is what I am reading of what academics are saying about academic policy.
Mm.
So you know, if I can quote an academic, and I'm not going to because, you know, it's not on the top of my head, but I have read academics stating, and whether they're right or not, who knows, it's just one opinion, isn't it? But then it's backed up by what someone else has said and what someone else has said. And certainly what we see in society, or what we see in that higher structure of society, is a shift in policy. Someone has gone and suggested, someone, an advisor, because let's be honest, I'm pretty sure that George Osborne isn't sitting there with his calculator himself. Yeah, I'm sure he's far too busy to actually be, you know, the man on the ground. He's got a whole team of people that is basically sort of saying, look, this isn't quite working now. What if we do it this way? You know, and that's been questioned because other people have come forward and said, well, no, if we do it this way, look, have you thought about how this is going to affect these hundreds of millions of people sort of thing, you know, or tens of millions of people or whatever. So it's all about changing policies. And at the end of the day, it's certainly in what I read in academia is that an argument is put forward on the strength of what people have said before.
Yeah. I think that the changing policies argument is also an interesting one, and comes quite timely because Graham, as artist formerly known as Graham in the chat box, has put, have you ever encountered resistance from building control or from common purpose in any of your projects? I mean, are you finding at any stage people just being plain bloody obstructive?
Personally, no. At the moment, I try to... Well, I'd like to sort of say I'm a good project manager. So equally, I have a good foresight of everything that's involved in the aspect of opening a building. I'm not doing anything stupid. You know, I know how many toilets that it needs to have. I know an incline of a ramp for disabled, or how many fire alarms to put around the building, et cetera, et cetera. So when things like building control, I'm actually sort of, you know, I know the rules and therefore I follow them. This education school, because we've actually, for the first time, I've actually changed the use of a building from a pub to a school for an education purpose. And therefore, building control are involved right at the beginning. So actually, they're telling me what I need to do before I even do it, even though obviously I do know the rules. So I've not really think it, I don't think it's a problem. And in anyone that ever wants to take on a building is don't try and cut corners on certain aspects of rules. Because I think they're there for a very strong reason.
I must admit that tends to be my opinion as well. At least in a lot of cases, there are a lot of very, very good points being made by planning authorities and stuff. My feeling is that just every now and then they could do with being a little bit more pliable, which presumably human relationships with them might help.
Well, I think that an aspect of, I think to how much someone has to apply for planning, you know, if you're not changing the use of a building, then in essence, you don't need to really, deal with any level of authority. If you're not changing, You know, if you're just literally renovating what is existing, which is mostly what I do, then really I'm not changing anything.
And if you're turning something like a theatre into an artist studio or whatever, or a pub into multiple places for artists, is that a change of use or not?
Well, the good thing about the arts, I guess this is my little loophole, is the arts fits into many, many categories of what is existing already. So if you've got an older cinema there, maybe that's not the best example, but we turned it into a theatre, then we're not really changing its use. If you create a gallery space, then out of a shop, and you put your arts for sale, then you're still a shop.
Okay, so do you play these kind of rules?
I do, yeah, I do. is the arts can be unfortunately interpreted in many, many ways, because no one has yet come up with the answer of what is art. And in my mind, everything that I've done has not changed the use of a building.
Brilliant. So it's not
where I built desk space. So you can go and rent a desk space in a space that was originally built as the offices to a bank. At the end of the day, it's just so I'm renting a desk in an old office. So I've not changed the use of the building at all.
Very good. So it's not so much a matter, because I was wondering when I was listening to you at Fire in the Mountain, I was wondering about permissions and applications and all this kind of stuff. It's not so much that you're not dealing with permissions, it's that you're dealing with them canny, aren't you?
Well, I guess that's what I say. Maybe it is my little loophole, and that has yet to face up to any argument. No one's come to me and sort of said, oh, you've done something wrong here. Obviously it's a question, but where I felt that I am specifically now, where we're talking about the move, I knew I was changing the use of that building because it was originally a pub and I was changing it to a school. So there is no way that I would try to not apply by the rules. And I quite enjoyed the aspect of, you know, I personally put together the plans. I personally filled out the application. I actually enjoyed the process. And paid the fee. You know, and I will do that again because I think some of my future projects will specifically start to change uses of buildings. Having done it, I didn't feel it was hard to do, and it all went through and got granted.
I guess quite a lot of practice and not changing the use of buildings, and in that process getting your face and your approach known about the place probably helped quite a lot.
Well, again, I just don't think I ever did anything wrong, so there wasn't a problem. So they didn't have to question it, really. And I guess just be thankful that the building's doing something that it was originally intended to do.
Mm-hmm. So your idea with the PhD is ultimately to start creating a template or a variety of templates that people can actually, so that people can learn from what you've been doing and start using these things with a bit of a head start. Is it working out that way? I know that's your intention.
Well, I'm still at the stage. I've still got another two and a half years, and at the moment, I've just finished my sort of literary review of all the academic writing. Then I've got to virtually write everything again. So I'll have written about 40,000 words come January. That is basically a review of everything I've read.
Ye gods, do you ever sleep, mate?
It's hard. But then I've got to write it again, and I've got to find a style, and that might be my hardest thing. I've got to find a style that I'd like to write is that template that everyone can copy or follow or take use of or just take a little bit. That there's information in there that basically means, look, it goes back to what I said about Cameron and big society, is that, okay, if you want to go and take over that building on the corner of your street, then here's some of the pitfalls that I've come up against. And here's the reasoning that might present the argument why you can achieve it as well as I have.
And do you have to finish your PhD before you can get any of these kind of these ideas into the public domain, do you think?
Well, Not necessarily. I've already done some talks. I do quite a few talks when they interest me. I've been invited to be part of a think tank for this Midlands Three Cities, which is an initiative. I don't know who runs it, but it combines the six universities over Birmingham, Leicester and Nottingham. And of course, I'm at Birmingham University and I did my MA at Leicester. So I kind of wanted to do that for that reason. So I'm actually taking part in a day conference, if that's the word, that talks to PhD students themselves about how they might be able to bring practice into their studies.
Excellent. And some of these, the talks you do, have we got any of those on YouTube yet?
Well, I've got, for my shames, I have I can't remember if it's Robert Howie Smith or one word, or Rob Howie Smith or something like that, a variation of that. I've got about four or five little short films and talks, that I've done, and, another one to put up there that I might, on my Wolf Talk, that I did up in Scotland. So yeah, I've got a few. There's a little record slowly of me getting older.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, because it'd be good to start. Is anybody kind of following you? Is anybody actually picking up on any of this work and starting to use your experience on their own behalf that you're aware of?
I get a lot of student requests quite often for conversations. We've got to do this or this project, or I've had those for a lot of years. Being invited to take part in things like this obviously part of my PhD, the success maybe in my future, is that I might be recognized for what I do. I'm not going to deny that. Certainly if I have a title in front of my name that I've well and truly earned, then it might give the recognition to give advice to others. It's always difficult to advise other people, in my mind, because people know what they want, really. But equally, if it gives me opportunity to talk about my experiences and share that and maybe get paid for doing that, then I don't mind doing that. Then that's something that's for my later years when the arthritis sets in.
Yeah, it certainly can work. That can, that giving talks and demonstrations and workshops can be a good way of turning a few promissory tokens, I think. And, carry on.
Yeah. And I think as well is obviously, every city has got a lot of problems and, you're seeing about them or in the news all the time. You know, the little strategies. It amused me when Swindon, I think, in one of their high streets put a whole digital images of what an interior of a shop in the empty shop of pictures of what it could look like if it was busy in their front windows or something like that. And you just think around or what that Mary Porter's did with Margate and things like that. We've been trying to look at this high street thing in many ways, but really I think in the future, if I'm in a position to be able to go into a city and just sort of say, look, this is what I did in that city, going back to what we said right at the beginning about being in London and going up to Liverpool and say, look what I did over here, can you let me do it here? Maybe that is a future that I'd gladly take part in.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is you could probably do with a couple of reliable lieutenants carrying the baton with you now. I mean,
I've met a lot of people along the way, and there's a lot of people I know do what I do, on different scales and in different approaches. I think there's a lot of people already carrying that baton.
And do you think there's likely to be any future in you working together to put together some sort of, I don't know, weekend or day course to put the most important lessons across to people? Because obviously with several of you doing it, that might make it a bit easier.
I don't know. I don't know. I've not thought of that. I don't know. Like I say, it's very, I mean, people can ask questions and my door is open at any time.
Yeah. Well, that seems fair enough. It's just that it seems to me there's such a wealth of experience amongst you and your builders and the various other people you've been working with. It kind of seems a shame not to be carrying it forward, but in the open, as it were. But I guess it's a bit difficult if you're doing a PhD because the kind of work...
Well, like I say, I guess at one point it's going to come out in the open. You know, at one point I'm going to sort of say, look, this is what I've written. Here's 80,000 words that talks about what I do and what I've learned and what other people say.
So we'll get a chance to read the PhD, you reckon?
Well, I'd like it to be that. Alongside, you know, if I go back to my original ideas as an artist, is that alongside this is a wealth of photography. My art is in photography, you know, and I still practice in a darkroom and enjoy it. My MA was in photography. And I'd like to, you know, over the years I've taken photographs from horrible buildings to nice buildings with people in them doing things. And alongside me, other people have taken photographs. What I'd like perhaps the story to be is something that has a visual element alongside the images of what I've actually seen and what I've created.
Yeah.
And others have created. You know, so maybe it becomes more of that coffee table book. Who knows?
Yeah, one of your projects has actually got a dark room and stuff in it, hasn't it? I mean, you've got quite a lot of different projects. I mean, I was looking.
Well, that's my dark room. Yeah, I've practiced black and white photography right from the beginning, back to the when I was 30, and got an interest in photography. You know, we didn't have digital cameras then. And I focused on black and white, and over the years I have had dark rooms in spaces that I've been projects, and that is part of why I believe we should support those forgotten arts, because the dark room has demised in our country quite extensively.
Yeah, which one of your projects is it that's got the dark room and the photographic studio in it? I can't remember.
It's in Station Street.
Right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yes. And then you've got the corner in Stony Street, which has got an event venue and an internet work hub and a performance and rehearsal theatre. Theatres are another thing that are disappearing quite quickly. Replacing them is a great idea, I think. Are you doing a lot of theatre work?
Well, funnily enough, the corner, the ground floor of the corner next year is one of those buildings that I'm again going to look at a change of use. I'm quite keen to say look at retail, and in the Lace Market area we've lost a little bit of retail to a rise in restaurants and pubs. There's that gentrification that, you know, we talked about that is happening at retail level perhaps. What I built at the corner was this rehearsal space that for 3 years worked wonderful as a rehearsal space. And thankfully, I think alongside a few other spaces, small independent theatre has really risen in Nottingham. Oh, I think it's risen. There's been some small groups really come to the forefront of small theatre in Nottingham. And it's led to several other places opening. And it's also led to me working with a group of theatre practitioners in the city, in fact, most of them, to actually negotiate a space, again off the council, that could be a dedicated theatre space. I won't have anything to do with it. All I'm offering to do is just stand beside the group of people and offer them my advice and support to make sure that they can bring the building back online.
It's one of my favourites, actually, is bringing back theatre space into use, because I've...
Yeah, I went to college at the Cumbria College of Arts, or whatever, Art and Design as it was then, and the Stanix Theatre is part of the college there, and in my second and third year I had a part-time job working in that theatre for wonderful, wonderful practitioners, you know, like Trestle, oh, I love Trestle. Mm-hmm. And they inspired my interest in mask making and small performance that I originally did when I left college, with this wolf stuff. And, I loved working in that small theatre, and Nottingham hasn't got one, and we've got a £25 Theatre Royal thing. Yeah, and we've got the £15 small Lace Market Theatre and Nottingham Arts Theatre. With very limited shows, but there doesn't seem to be as what I would call that £5, £10 ticket. Yet I know it tours the country.
Yeah, I think that's difficult to find anywhere now. I mean, even out in Mid Wales, we're charging £7.50 or £10 for a theatre ticket. I mean,
but we don't have that. We haven't got a space for the £10 theatre ticket, which is a shame. And I'd very much love to see it in Nottingham because it's one of my favourite levels of entertainment.
And I think even more than the music, the modern drama is really suiting itself to the age, if you know what I mean. I really got reintroduced to theatre probably about 8 or 10 years ago when I got sucked out of a manure heap and put onto a stage first time for 20 years or so. And I'd forgotten how life-changing working in a theatrical team can be. You know, you're working with other people. It's important that they are where they're supposed to be and that they say what they're going to say. There's lighting, there's costume, there's so many different things, all of which have got to come together night after night. And I find myself that actually getting involved in that, you're actively pretending to be somebody else. You're casting an illusion that's supposed to kind of weave a spell over the audience. It's an utterly magical experience, which until you've actually tried it, you can't really appreciate. And certainly in Wales, what's happening is we're losing theatre spaces and theatre opportunities and theatre funding at a massive rate. It's all getting kind of sucked into Cardiff and is no longer finding its way out into the shires. And I think for me, certainly, to be able to go onto a stage, to spend a few hours pretending to be somebody else, when you stop and come back off the stage again, you're not the same individual that went on there. You've had a genuine break from the kind of trials of everyday life and all of that. So, I'd massively congratulate you on you know, keeping theatre spaces rolling. I noticed earlier on you said that for a while you were, one of the buildings you were using was the original Nottingham Playhouse, which I know from when I was a lad. That's a truly, truly beautiful playhouse. Do you still have that, or did it move on?
No. That was I worked for someone else then that owned it. I was in pub management. I was managing a bar in the city, and the guy who I worked for owned a derelict, what he thought was a derelict old clothing warehouse thing down near Rock City, if people know that. There's a good landmark. I went into it and sort of said, well, we could turn this into a bar with his money and with brewery money, I guess, in those days. We set about building a team. I was running the Arboretum Pub. I guess this is where it sort of all began, I guess, really, because I was running the Arboretum Pub, which in the city is just behind the Polytechnic University, as it is now. And it became a very, very popular student venue around the mid-90s. And through it, I met everybody that is capable of designing and doing, you know, the groundwork to setting up a bar. So I worked with graduates that year and gave all the graduates that I knew that was capable of working with me jobs. They'd been my clientele for 3 years, and I'd took their money for years. So I felt obliged to try and give them something back, I guess. And we employed as many, you know, graduates in design and visual aspects, and some of them even worked in the building and the construction. And it was really enjoyable to do with so many people that I already knew. And I think helped and gave them their first job out of university. And we built this building, and as we knocked it apart, we found this all old architraving stuff up in the ceiling, and discovered that it had been the original Nottingham Playhouse. And
it was all completely hidden.
Yeah, it was all closed off, and no one really knew that it had been. It wasn't. Hadn't been talked about. The guy who owned it didn't know, hadn't been told that when he bought it.
Christ. So, and it's still a pub?
And it's still a pub. It's Spanky Van Dyke's. Yeah.
God, do you know? I'm going to have to come up and see you and have a look at some of these projects. I'd love to go and have a beer in the old playhouse. That'd be great.
Yeah, and they play on it now. They've got fake architraving over the what would have been the original architraving up in the roof to make of the upstairs performance space. But then we opened it as the Tivoli Beer Restaurant, which subsequently, as I recall, was the first licensed premise to open in the city for 8 years, as I remember. And it then led to a flood of what happened in the mid-90s onwards in Nottingham, where it became what it is now, where we seem to have, you know, bars everywhere.
Well, I do find all of this kind of like, you know, quite optimistic, really, because I think that at least in... It's got to be true to say that as one thing falls apart, other things come together. And I think it's really important to be planting the kind of seeds that you're planting. It sounds like your influence is growing and spreading and that more people are doing the work and stuff. And perhaps we might... It's not just a matter of taking over these beautiful derelict spaces. It is a matter of making sure that they don't get knocked down and can continue to be beautiful spaces. But most of all, it seems to me that your desire to give artistic people a bit of a chance and to give young people a chance to kind of follow their dreams and visions and stuff is also important, because this is all marginalised stuff that you are slowly but surely demarginalising.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I think I would agree with that.
So your music project in Leicester is clearly going to take you a fair bit of time. I mean, you had your first networking day today. How did that go?
Yeah, I popped over at the beginning because I had to come back and talk to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good. I know a few people in Leicester. I've met a few. I'm really looking forward to meeting a lot more. And I think this project will. And I think as well, this was put together by a friend of mine, Robin. He heads off the Canning Circus Hub of Artists, which is a creative space similar to what I do on another part of the city. And I've known him for quite a while. We share a birthday, which is nice. He's introduced me to, he works over in Leicester. He's going to be working at this college. And he's introduced me to a lot. And what we've got also opportunity as well to do is by creating a performance space in Leicester and having performance spaces in Nottingham is to start a bit of a crossover independently and very much encourage, if anything, a unification of both cities in the East Midlands, because both cities are, I think, quite rocking it for live music at the moment.
Yeah, although, again, when I was in Leicester last, it had, I think, lost... It used to have places like the Little Theatre. It had a lot of small drama spaces, but I think they'd all more or less gone to be replaced by the Haymarket Theatre when I was living there, so I'm...
I'm talking about live music, like as a live music spaces. You know, you've still got the Musician and the Shed in Leicester, which are quite long-standing, and a few other little places. I agree with what you're saying about theatre. Theatre lost out a little bit in Leicester and hasn't been replaced. This performance space that we're building can suit both music and theatre. Mm. So maybe that might fill a little gap.
Absolutely brilliant. And what other favourite projects have you got on at the moment, apart from your music school?
Well, I've been... If you look on my website, there's that little section on outdoor art.
Yeah.
What I've managed to do over the few years is equally get access to outside walls legally so that we can see more street art. And one of the spaces opposite the corner is up for renewal. So I've been working out how I can get a cheap articulated boom lift.
Just what we all need.
And then equally, we're going to put it for an open tender. There's four immense walls, 50-foot high walls. There's four of them. And we'd approached sections of it. But what we're hoping to do is put together an open tender, open it out to street artists in the city and who are maybe further afield, but certainly in the city, because there are some wonderful street artists in our city, and as there are in every city. But equally that we can actually approach this huge, immense wall with a variety of what Nottingham's got to offer. And I'm kind of enjoying trying that challenge. Putting it all together, there's quite a lot of people I have to deal with to so that they're all happy.
Brilliant. Well, I think that's all. I think that's all really most uplifting. And I mean, you know, in the process, you're dealing with craftsmen. People are getting paid. You're needing to deal with authorities and try and convince them that they don't need to have your taxes and stuff. You're doing regeneration of cities. You're doing social work. There's elements of environmental work. You're building communities. You're providing young people and artists with opportunities, as well as older people with opportunities to work on the things. You're moving towards training people and helping them out. You're providing opportunities for a bit of employment, experimentation, self-employment, sustainability of individuals, giving people a chance to be kind of independent, having a hand in education and creating spaces for people. It's pretty amazing, mate. I think, really, it's a stunning project, really. 10 out of 10 to you.
I should pay you as my PR manager, shouldn't I?
Well, I'd love to keep up with you. In fact, at some point when I get a chance to come back to the Midlands, it would be great to come up and have a look at some of this stuff, if it's possible, because I think it really...
You're more than welcome. That aspect of community, there's always a door open.
Brilliant. Well, I am hoping this winter to do a bit of a probably two or three little tours, you know, south of England, Midlands, and hopefully back up to Scotland again. And it'd be great to include you in that and maybe come and spend a couple of days looking at what's going on.
No, you're more than welcome. You're more than welcome. It was really good when I met you in on the mountain. I was about to say in the woods.
Yeah.
But it was more on the mountain.
Do you think you'll be coming back to Fire in the Mountain next year?
I just saw that they've put a call out for musicians and artists to come forward. So obviously it's going ahead. I'm not too sure. Obviously there'll be new speakers in their debate tent, but I know a lot of the organizers, or some of the organizers, I wouldn't say a lot because there are a lot of people involved in that festival. But I really did enjoy seeing Rob Heron and his T-Pad orchestra.
Yeah. I'll try and put a tune on by them before the end of the show.
That's a welcome. There's my request for the night.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put one of those on. Well, you've put in a sterling performance for us. Thank you very much for putting in the time. It'd be great to have you back on again. If you've got stuff you want to talk about or kind of put forward, if you've got a discussion you want to have and you need a radio station to have it on, then feel free to give me a shout. And thanks really from me and from all the people in the chat box for the time you put in and for the work you're doing, I think.
Well, I look forward to listening back on my voice over the radio.
Brilliant. Well, I'll let you know as soon as the podcast's up. I try and get them up within a week or so, but I don't always succeed. So,
if I come back again, we'll talk Wolves.
Brilliant. Yeah, I'd love to talk about Wolves. I'd also like to talk, perhaps there's another thing we could touch on just quickly before I let you go is, I know you've got a really heartfelt YouTube video up about, the importance of family and community, and it seems to me that you're building wider families in the cities with your projects, but you're obviously deeply involved in as well the effect the no-fit state's having on the family.
It's a difficult subject to go into, but I've had a lot of heartache in divorce and difficulty in being able to have a relationship with my children. And I have found that the system is very unsupportive to the fathers that get to miss out.
Yeah.
And I'm having to very slowly go through the process. I am slowly having to go through the legal process to get where I am, and it's taking a long time. And money, and unfortunately, that's the one aspect that I don't have. So, it's a difficult one. And the YouTube video, I think the element that I really would put across to the joys in life that I have is the what's the old saying? Is you choose your friends and you don't choose your family, so to speak, or whatever. But the friends that I've made in aspect, I think, can equally be as close as family.
Brilliant. Well, like I say, thank you very much for your time and for that. Robert Howie Smith on YouTube, you can find that little video of his. And I'll try and keep up with you, Rob.
All right, mate. Good one. You take care. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much. And I'll talk with you again. I'll be in touch on the Skype shortly.
All right, you take care.
And you, sir, thank you very much for your time. Thanks. So that was Robert Howie Smith giving us a chapter and verse on his very interesting and expensive social enterprise. I'm now desperate myself for a wee break, so I'm going to put on Dexter Dextrous and his Fingersmiths, and that's life. I'll be back with you in 10 minutes or so. Ooh.